From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I'm thinking about trilliums, prompted not just because these treasured spring ephemerals are coming into their season, but by the disturbing news in a report just published that found that 32% of all North American trillium species or varieties are threatened with extinction. My guest is Amy Hyland, the Director of Collections and Conservation Lead at Mount Cuba Center, a botanic garden and native plant conservation nonprofit in Delaware, one of three organizations behind the findings. More in a moment, but first these messages.
Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now. Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
As Mount Cuba Center's Director of Collections and Conservation Lead, Amy Hyland, a graduate of Purdue's Public Horticulture Program, has traveled throughout the temperate forests of North America to find rare plants in need of conservation. She's here today to talk trilliums and also how we as gardeners can be more involved in conservation of native plants overall. Hi, Amy, how are you?
Hello, Margaret. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, happy spring. I bet it's beautiful down there at Mount Cuba right now.
It is. Things are popping every day.
I bet. So the report that I've read and all of this information about trilliums that we're going to get into, I was not surprised to see Mount Cuba as one of the three conservation organizations behind this report on the endangered status of trillium. But one of the others, the New Mexico Biopark Society or Albuquerque Biopark, it did surprise me because I don't think there are any native trillium in New Mexico, are there? So tell us about them and about the third partner, NatureServe, and how you all did this.
That's true. There are not any trillium species native to New Mexico. And that was not lost on the researchers from the biopark either. And it is one of the reasons why we held our workshop time here at Mount Cuba Center, where we could see some of these specimens as opposed to there in Albuquerque. But the New Mexico Biopark has a commitment to these assessments of how plants are doing in the wild. And they work regularly with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature on medicinal plant species. And a little known fact is that trillium is actually a medicinal plant species. So they were asked to pursue trillium as one of the early assessments that they did. They reached out to us at Mount Cuba because of our national collection of trillium. And we were able to pull together our third partner, NatureServe, because they also have an assessment process that they use, and worked with every trillium expert that we could find in North America.
Mm. NatureServe also has the NatureServe Explorer, the sort of search tool. I mean, I'm just a Malay person, but you know, that I use if I want to find out kind of the range of a plant in you know, where its wild range is or whatever, where you can type in a genus and species and it kind of populates a map in real time of where that plant is occurring and so forth. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
NatureServe is a fantastic resource. They not only create maps, but they regularly work with botanists, you know, boots on the ground, looking at these plants in the wild to say, how are they doing? Is this population under threat? Does this population need some external conservation or that kind of thing? Do we need to put a land easement together for this population? So NatureServe actually consists of an entire network of botanists across the US and Canada, and also internationally, to look at these plants and to evaluate how they're doing.
Right.
And then after they bring together all of these assessments, sometimes there are these kinds of workshops or events where we come together and we say, okay, if you know that your trillium is doing well and you know that your trillium is doing well, well, how is the entire genus or the entire family doing in North America? And that's what this study really allowed us to do was to look for the first time holistically at all of these plants across North America and give a true assessment of their status so that we can make conservation decisions in the future.
So let's just talk about how many trilliums are there in the world, like how many species and how many are where, because I think North America has the lion's share of them, yes?
That's correct. There are thought to be three areas in the world where trillium diversity kind of concentrates. The highest concentration of trillium species is going to be in the American Southeast. Mm-hmm. The second highest is in the American Northwest. And then the third is an Asian concentration. So there are three centers where a lot of evolution happened. And you're going to find more species in those areas where there is a lot of diversity because of that evolutionary history.
Interesting that there are three centers since everything in trilliums comes in threes.
Oh, isn't that cute? Yes, I've never thought of it like that.
Yeah, because, right? I mean, all the parts are in threes, yes?
Yes, they are. That's where its name comes from, trillium, parts of three. Three petals, three sepals, three leaves.
Yeah, interesting. I'm always fascinated by their intimate relationship with independence, really, on or interdependence with ants that are their kind of that love that the juicy bit on their seeds and move the seeds around. And I just love all that kind of those stories of interconnections between animals and plants. So,
yes, that's a story that many spring ephemerals have. They produce the fatty packet that you're talking about, the elaiosome on their seed that's attractive to ants and other insects. And one of the best things about trillium is, you know, when you see it in the wild and you feel like you stumbled across some sort of fairy magic, like, who put this plant here? This is amazing.
Right.
But because of the way they're dispersed through ants or that kind of thing, you can sometimes see them in really interesting patterns, like a ring of trillium. And you think, oh my goodness, who planted this here? Well, it was the ants, you know, they were carrying their seed and somewhere along the way, it got too heavy and it just fell there and it could create a little circle of trillium.
Sweet. So with the research, with the report, what were the sort of major takeaways? I mean, if 32% of all North American trillium species or varieties are threatened with extinction, what are the drivers of that bleak news?
We did take the time to delineate certain threats that are affecting trillium all across the country. Some of them are no surprise to any of us, land use change, human development, or even how water moves across the land, right? When we change that as humans, it has rippling effects throughout our ecosystems. Another one is white-tailed deer.
Yes.
We have huge white-tailed deer populations, and trillium are particularly delicious. So when a trillium is eaten by a deer, it kind of sets back the life cycle of that trillium plant for a few growing seasons, depending upon how much it already had stored in its root system. But if a deer comes along and takes a bite of the trillium, the next year it won't produce all three leaves. It'll go back to its juvenile days and produce maybe one leaf that year, but it will take it several seasons before it's capable of producing a flower again and therefore reproducing at all. So the white-tailed deer really do harm trillium populations, and that's something we saw over and over again in this study.
And that's one not that was unique to trillium. I mean, white-tailed deer in these large herds and so forth, they have become predators, whatever you would use the word, of many native species of plants. Yes, I mean,
yes, that's
implicated.
Very accurate.
Yeah,
they're hungry, and there's a lot of them. And the natural areas where they used to find refuge are becoming smaller or disappearing altogether.
Right. So animal predation by deer is one is one factor that was in the report. Any other, and there were others, of course.
Oh, yes. The one that was maybe the most interesting for us, or at least got the most laughs around the table, was the feral hog situation in the South.
As in pigs?
As in pigs, yes.
Okay.
These are pigs that either escaped domesticated pens or were seeded into forests by hunters or that kind of thing. And I think years ago, you know, we used to hear about feral hogs on islands where they could just destroy the ecosystem of the island. Well, now they are widespread throughout the American South and they are pushing their way north.
Oh.
And as they do this, they are eating as they go.
Right.
But the major difference between a feral hog and a deer is that a deer will come up and take a bite. A pig will root up the roots itself, and they can destroy a population overnight.
Wow. I had no idea. I had no idea.
And they reproduce very quickly. They have large litters.
Oh.
And there's a lot of food that's required to sustain them. So we're seeing the effects of feral hogs on our trillium plants as well.
Wow. I really had no idea that that was an issue. Well, what other good news was there for the plight of trillium in the wild?
Well, the good news is that people are interested in trillium. They're that charismatic megaflora, you know, the big shiny flowers that people are interested in. And that gives us a little bit of a leg up when trying to preserve these plants in the wild. People can understand the need to preserve something so beautiful. So that was a bright spot. And we are finding that the threats we've identified are not insurmountable. There are absolutely ways to preserve these plants long-term. We simply have to make a commitment to do it and allocate the funding that's going to be necessary for the preservation. Mm.
We know a lot and read a lot and hear a lot about invasive species. Were there non-animal, I mean, plants, invasive species, is there competition for turfs, literally,
yes,
from invasive plants as well in the case of trilliums?
Yes, there absolutely are. The worst offenders that I'm sure all of your listeners deal with, the kudzus, the multiflora roses, those kinds of plants are taking up the resources that these trilliums need to thrive. However, we did note that it was sometimes a double-edged sword. So sometimes a patch of multiflora rose will actually protect a trillium population because the deer don't want to deal with the multiflora rose any more than we do.
Right.
So it slows them down and makes it so that they can't get easy access to that delicious trillium leaf.
Interesting. So as I said in the introduction, you've traveled extensively in the temperate world, observing native plants in their natural habitats. You've undoubtedly seen trilliums in theirs. What kind of habitats do they occur in nature? And like, who are their partners and so forth?
Oh, sure. Well, being ephemerals, early spring wildflowers, they have some companions that we try to mimic here at Mount Cuba Center as well when you see them in the garden. Mm-hmm. So common plants like Virginia bluebells or barren strawberries or bloodroot are all things that I see with trillium usually. Trillium, like the Eastern Temperate Forest, many of them evolved here. They're very happy in these environments. They tend to like things a little bit more pristine than, say, our common bluebells. Bluebells, you know, they're happy just about anywhere, but trillium require less soil disturbance. They need ready access to water. I'll often find them growing along a stream or a little rivulet.
Oh.
Sometimes they need protection. So you'll find them tucked up under a boulder on a embankment, or you'll see them on the downward side of a giant tree where they're just looking to seek out a little bit of shelter from both predation and the elements.
Interesting. When we spoke the other day on the phone, I told you that the first Trilliums I ever met were about 35 or more years ago, and I bought the near upstate New York house that I live in now full time when I was a weekender. And I was doing a repair on the front porch, and I saw under the deck of the porch, just tucked under the edge, speaking of protection, I saw these three little plants, and I didn't know what they were. And I dug them up because I thought, why would a plant want to live under the porch? and put them in a garden bed that I was making. And they turned out to be the wake robin or Trillium erectum, sort of a reddish colored native Trillium to my area, my region. And I've since, they've multiplied and so on and so forth. So some of them are tough little guys, but not under the pressures that you were talking about before, obviously.
That's right. And yeah. Probably there near your home, the deer were a little bit too timid to get to your porch.
Right, right.
You'll actually see that effect happen in the wild too, specifically at like national parks or that kind of thing. You can search an entire forest segment, and sometimes the greatest diversity in that forest segment is right along the roadside. The only reason for that is that the deer are intimidated by the road traffic.
Right.
So the 5 feet before that road, they won't necessarily browse everything to death.
Wow. So that's our new direction in conservation, is that we're going to populate roads, highway edges with, instead of the horrible things we've always put along them, we're going to try this instead, I guess.
We should. Yeah. And absolutely, we should work towards not using pesticides, herbicides on roadsides, because so many species need those roadsides as refugia, a place to survive.
Right. I never thought about that. That's very interesting. Sort of when you want to tell gardeners or other members of your audience that you reach through your work at Mount Cuba or the people we're talking to today, kind of what we can do. I mean, you know, so I can grow my trilliums here in the garden and so forth, and I can not use chemicals, and I can grow native diversity of native plants and the things that we talk about a lot in gardening these days. But do you have some messages, I think, for us about how we can participate in conservation and so forth as well?
Yes. The first one is simply what we're doing today, which is learning more about biodiversity. It's often shocking to people to learn that there's more than one Trillium, or you know, more than one clematis, or that the European version of something that you've been growing actually has a counterpart here in North America that, you know, fits a little bit better in with the ecosystem. So whenever possible, I encourage people to learn as much as they can about the environment and to pass that knowledge on. We all have friends that we talk to, or grandchildren, or whomever it is, and sharing our love of nature is very infectious. And I think it's going to do a lot for conservation in the future.
Right.
The other one I often say is conservation can be conservation by addition. We don't need to get rid of everything that we've ever had before in favor of a native plant garden. Native plants play very well with non-native plants. And if you are growing your grandmother's roses, you do not have to stop growing those grandmother's roses. Just maybe put a native phlox in there as well, so that we're supporting the butterflies and the bees and the soil organisms and all of those things.
Right. And sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. The last one would really be just to, if you want to participate in the conservation of these species, don't go it alone. There are a lot of people studying these plants. There's a lot of great conservation organizations in this part of the country that are looking into these things and need help. So certainly look into someone who's interested in the species that you're interested in and see how you could participate.
Right. I mean, in your area, of course, in the Mid-Atlantic, I mean, Mount Cuba is such a place to do all those things, really, to learn, to find out which plants to become more involved. And there are there are great places in most or all regions of the country. So I often look on the, and I'm going to get the name wrong, but it's like the national, it's a website of the National sort of Native Plant Society. And I'll give the right link and name with the, I'm sorry, I forgot it, but with the transcript of the show over my website. But it has state by state and Canadian province by Canadian province, a whole list of all of the native plant societies and entities like Mount Cuba. So you can actually zero in on your own, do you know what I mean? And find a place that you can meet like-minded people and learn more and so forth. And often even attend a plant sale and find locally appropriate native plants. So that's, I think, positive too. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And I'm so glad that you mentioned local plant sales as well, because as gardeners, as horticulturists, you know, one of the things that we can do very, very easily is make sure we know where our plants come from.
Right.
We can always speak to nurserymen and make sure that the plants are legally and ethically obtained. These plants are grown in cultivation. You can absolutely get them from a nursery. It takes a really long time to produce one, but you can get them. So make sure that if you are going to buy a trillium for your garden, that you're going to a Plant Delights nursery or someone with a very good reputation, so that we're making sure that these plants are not being poached from the wild.
Right, right. We have a few minutes left, and you mentioned earlier medicinal use and that had led to some of their poaching earlier on and so forth in the case of trillium. What are they also used? Did I read in the report that they're used in the skincare industry or something that I didn't know about? What's that sort of ethnobotanical or whatever aspect of trillium?
One of the common names of trillium is birthwort. And once upon a time, it was used to help women in childbirth and that kind of thing. Today, they are primarily used in the skincare industry. It produces an astringent-like effect. If you want a natural astringent, trillium is one of the plants that can provide that for you. The problem is it's really only one, maybe two species that provide that astringent quality. And unfortunately, we are seeing an uptick in poaching happening from trillium of all species, because the people poaching them can't tell the difference. Being taken from the wild and presumably being sold to the skincare industry.
You also mentioned just in the last 2 minutes, tell me, in the beginning you mentioned the sort of national collection, so to speak, of trillium, that you have this enormous collection there at Mount Cuba. How diverse is it? And they're profiled on the website, I think, as well. The Mount Cuba website has great plant profiles and incredible pictures. And so if people want to dig deeper, and again, I'll give the link for that. But how diverse is that collection?
We have roughly 84 taxa of trillium here at Mount Cuba Center. That's varieties, species, types of trillium. We have horticultural forms. They are cultivars that are just grown to be beautiful. We have wild sourced material that is meant to live here until it's needed back out in the wild, and then we will be able to propagate and put it back. We have carpets of trillium at this time of year. It's actually a great time to visit because our trillium garden is in full bloom, but it will be so until about the second week of May.
Wow. That's a long season. That's amazing. Huh. Yeah, that must be just incredibly beautiful. Well, Amy Hyland, I'm so glad that you and your colleagues did this work in collaboration with these other entities again, but also that I'm always glad to talk to anyone at Mount Cuba, because for me, it's been over so many years, it's been such an influence in my personal interest in native plants. And as I said, it has so many great resources that I'll give the links to with the transcript for people wherever they are. Although it's mid-Atlantic focused, I think it's very inspirational for people everywhere. So thank you for making the time today. And thanks for the work that went into this this report. Pigs and all, oh my goodness. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Margaret. We hope to have you here again soon sometime.
Okay. And thanks. Talk to you soon.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com. Programming and underwriting support from Royal Botanic Gardens, publishers of Kew Pocketbook, Small Gift Books Illustrated from Kew's vast collection of botanical art. The most recent book, Fungi, about the strange and singular world of mushrooms, toadstools, and their kin. In bookstores now.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again, too. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.